The following is a message from Pastor Ellis Orozco of First Baptist Richardson. For more information, please visit fbcr.org.
Good morning, and thanks for worshiping this morning with all your heart, all your soul, and all your strength. Now we're going to go to God's Word and ask Jesus to speak to us. We're in a series of sermons called Generosity. We're talking about the spirit of generosity and how important it is that we have, as a church, a spirit of generosity in order to fulfill our mission, which is to bring healing and wholeness to our community and beyond, even as we are being transformed by Jesus. So to do that, let's go today to one of the letters of John, the Apostle John, writing in his first letter, chapter 2, and I'll be reading verses 3 to 11. 1 John, chapter 2, beginning with verse 3, reading all the way to verse 11, this is what the Word of God says. We know that we have come to know Him, Jesus, if we obey His commands. The man who says, I know Him, but does not do what He commands, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But if anyone obeys His word, God's love is truly made complete in him. This is how we know we are in Him. Whoever claims to live in Him must walk as Jesus did. Dear friends, I am not writing you a new command, but an old one, which you have had since the beginning. This old command is the message you have heard. Yet I am writing you a new command. Its truth is seen in Him and you, because the darkness is passing and the true light is already shining. Anyone who claims to be in the light but hates his brother is still in the darkness. Whoever loves his brother lives in the light, and there is nothing in him to make him stumble. But whoever hates his brother is in the darkness and walks around in the darkness. He does not know where he is going because the darkness has blinded him. A McDonald's assistant manager in Lynn, Massachusetts, named Andrea De La Rosa, has developed a reputation at that McDonald's and throughout the community for her kindness, especially with her employees, most of them high school students who are working their first job. And she takes time to listen to them and to help them with things like filling out college applications. She's known for this. One particular student, 18-year-old Emmanuel Graham, was one of her employees when he was in high school. He is now a business major at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. And I want you to hear their story. So watch this video.
Of all the fates that could have fallen on 18-year-old Emmanuel Graham, business student at the University of Massachusetts Lowell seemed most unlikely of all. Both his parents died before his 13th birthday.
After those years, I kept messing up at school because both of my biggest support systems, they were gone.
So you were rudderless all the way through junior year in high school?
I didn't think I would make it to college or senior year.
Emmanuel credits his remarkable turnaround, at least in part, to a mentor. A woman who has offered countless kids in Lynn, Massachusetts, a heaping helping of love and guidance. Along with a side of fries.
Hola! I get so excited when I walk in the door because I know what I'm coming to now. I'm coming to my family.
This is McDonald's assistant manager, Andrea De La Rosa. Emmanuel used to work for Andrea and gave her the nickname Mama McDonald's.
I appreciate you, Mama.
You never stop being a mother just because they're not your kids.
To Andrea, managing young people on their first jobs is about so much more than barking orders. It's about listening.
I went to school today.
Helping with homework, college applications, really any issue, at any hour, for every kid who works here.
She treats me as if she's a child. She always checks on me. She makes sure I have everything that I need.
It doesn't matter what time of the day it is. At night, she'll pick up.
She will pick up. I don't have a relationship with my mother. Dre gives me the mother figure that I never had.
It's just a little bit of kindness, a little bit of love that means the world to somebody.
At a time when most employers are offering incentives if you stay, Andrea is offering unconditional love, no matter where your career takes you.
I love you too.
And as a result, employees are receiving bonuses of immeasurable value.
To have a person of support to help me go through it, it kind of like slowly healed like what I was missing.
And as for his future, Emmanuel says he doesn't know yet what kind of business he'll go into. He just knows the kind of boss he wants to be. Steve Hartman, on the road, in Lynn, Massachusetts.
Now, I don't know how much an assistant manager at McDonald's in Lynn, Massachusetts makes, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Andrea is probably not a multimillionaire. Generosity is not about how much. Generosity is not about how much you have, but it's how much you give out of what you do have. I want us to take some time this morning to take a look at the spirit of generosity, not from a material perspective or a financial perspective. I want to look at the spirit of generosity as the act of loving other people. And I want you to begin to see that every time you go out of your way to help another person or to love other people, that in and of itself is an act of generosity. Now, some people are very easy to love. Some people are very lovable and easy to love. I'm not talking about those people. That they don't count. If someone is easy to love and you love them, that in some ways doesn't count as an act of generosity. This is what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, his famous Sermon on the Mount. He said this, "You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that?" Jesus is saying here, it's easy to love the people who love you. Here is the one true act of generosity. Try loving the person who does not necessarily love you back. Try loving the person who has never given you any reason to love them and may never give you a reason to love them. This is what Jesus is saying. That is a true act of generosity. Jesus said, what's the big deal in loving the people who love you back? Anyone can do that. I love my daughter, Celeste. She lives in New York now, but I love her with all my heart, and she's easy to love. She texts me every day telling me how much she appreciates me and how much she loves me. I love my 8-year-old granddaughter, Eden, because she expresses every day her love for me, her appreciation for me. She gives me hugs and she kisses my cheek and she tells me that she loves her pops. My daughter, Celeste, my granddaughter, Eden, I mean, look at them. They're easy to love. What's not to love? But here is the true act of generosity. When you can love someone who is not very lovable, when you can love someone who is not necessarily loving you back. This is what the Apostle John is saying in his letter. It's really very simple. It's simple to understand. A first grader could understand it. If you love Jesus, then you will obey him, you will watch him, and you will begin to live the way he lived. I actually like the way the King James Version says it in verse 6, a very important passage. Verse 6, it says, "He that saith he abideth in him," in Jesus, "ought himself also to walk even as he walked." To walk as Jesus walked. T.B. Maston was one of the great ethicists, Christian, and he happened to be Baptist. Christian ethicist of the last century. He taught at Southwestern Seminary, the seminary where I got my master's degree. And T.B. Maston wrote two books on biblical ethics. The first was called Biblical Ethics. The second, a more slender volume, was called To Walk as He Walked. It was taken from this very verse out of 1 John chapter 2, verse 6. To walk as he walked. And in that book, he says, he claims, he proposes that to live the ethical life as a Christian is simply to walk as Jesus walked. That book was required reading when I was in seminary. If you read the book, it's so simple. It's a very simple, simple book. In fact, after I read it, I thought to myself, I could have written that. But as I have pondered the truths in that book over the years, I now realize, no, I couldn't. I couldn't have written it because it was simple, yet it was incredibly profound. Simple to understand, But it's taking a lifetime to try and live it out, to walk as Jesus walked. Simple, simple to look at, but very difficult to do. I love going to museums. In particular, I love art museums. I take a trip to Fort Worth at least once, sometimes twice a year, to eat at my favorite restaurants there in Fort Worth and to go to the Kimball Art Museum, one of the finest museums in our area. And they often have, sometimes we'll have the modern art. I appreciate a little bit more the classical art. I'm a little confounded sometimes by the modern art, but every once in a while I'll see a painting, maybe a large painting up on the wall, and I look at it and I think, you know, this modern art, and I look at it, triangles and circles and lines. I look at it and I think to myself, I could have done that, right? I could have painted that. But then when you start to begin, you begin to study art and you begin to study the depth of what is actually on that canvas, at some point you realize, no, I probably couldn't have painted that. I mean, I could copy it, but I couldn't myself have painted that, because it looks simple, but it's actually quite difficult. John is what he's doing in his letter. He writes his letter to the church, and it's a simple letter. John was a simple fisherman. The letter is not hard to understand. It's simple. It's just difficult to do. And John gives us this one kind of singular mission as a Christian. If you want to walk as Jesus walked, if you want to have this spirit of generosity that Jesus had with his love, then you have to, John says, you have to walk in the light. You have to walk in the light. This is the one singular mission that we have. It is to walk in the light. It sounds easy, but it's not. So let's unpack that. Let's do that this morning. We're going to ask ourselves, what does this mean? What does it mean to walk as Jesus walked? What does it mean to walk in the light of Jesus? And John gives it to us here in this, the passage we read. Two very simple things. The first is that to walk in the light of Jesus means to live for the truth. It means to live your life for the truth. And always the truth. Look at what he says in verses 7 and 8. He says, "Dear friends, I'm not writing you a new command, but an old one, which you have had since the beginning. The old command is the message you have heard. Yet I am writing you a new command. Its truth is seen in him and in you." It's seen in him and in you, because the darkness is passing and the true light is already shining. So he wants to say, the message, the foundational message, he says, is an old message. It goes all the way back to the beginning of time. It's an old message, all the way back to Abraham, where God says to Abraham, "I am going to bless you so that you can be a blessing to the world. I'm going to bless Abraham. I'm going to bless those who bless him and curse those who curse him. And I'm going to create this people of God who are going to be a blessing to the entire world." In other words, you get the blessing in order that you can share that blessing. He says, this is the message. And it's as old as Abraham. It's as old as Moses, who gave us the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments basically say, love God and love other people. The first four telling you how to love God, and the other six telling you how to love other people. You see, the message is old. The message is old, John says. But Jesus has made it new again. He says, yet it is new because Jesus has given us this message in living color. Here's the command, which is grounded in the old command, and that is that the light has come into the world and you are to walk in that light. John, in his gospel, by the way, he wrote his gospel after he wrote the letter. So the letter we're reading in 1 John is actually older than the gospel of John. So later, when he's writing the Gospel of John, he begins that gospel with the echoes of his letter. You can see that they are the same person writing, because John is saying, you must now walk in the light. And the prologue to John's gospel, John chapter 1, where he's describing Jesus, is all about Jesus being the light. Look at what he says there in the prologue. He says, "The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world." He's talking about Jesus. "The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world." He goes on to say that some did not recognize the light, but to those who did, to those who did recognize the light, to those who believed in the name of Jesus, God has given them the right to become children of God, he says. Children of God, children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. See, the truth of God's generous love is seen in Jesus. It's seen in Jesus. He is the light of the world. It's seen in Jesus. And then it is seen in you when you are living like Jesus, when you are walking as he walked, when you're giving your life to him, then that light shines through you. And this is how we know that the darkness is passing. It's the only way we could possibly know that the darkness in this world is passing away and that the light is replacing it. The only way we know that, John says, is when we see the light of Jesus reflected in his followers. When Jesus' light is reflected in you, it is a sign to the world that the darkness is passing. And it is the only sign. Just look all around you. Look, read the newspaper. Look at the news. What the darkness is everywhere. And the only sign that darkness is passing is the light that Jesus brings into the world through you and through his church. The generous love of Jesus. It's when we see the truth in Jesus and when that truth shines in us. Jesus told us this. He said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. You live in the truth of his light, and that light sets you free. He went on later to say of himself, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Jesus is that one rock solid truth. And that has never been more important to understand than it is today. Our society and our culture is being overwhelmed to some degree by a fairly recent philosophy called deconstructionism. Deconstructionism is a fairly complicated philosophy. Dates all the way back to the early 20th century, but has really taken root in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and even to today. And it's quite complicated, and it hits several different philosophies. It's more of a movement of deconstructionism that seeks to deconstruct everything that we know and to try and build it back up again. But one of the governing tenets, and probably the most dangerous tenet of deconstructionism, is the idea that all truth is relative, that all morality is relative, that every generation or every culture or every nation decides for itself what truth is, that there is no final or objective truth, that it's all relative. But we know from the Bible that the Bible says that there is one never changing, never ending, completely objective truth, and his name is Jesus. And that's where we stake our claim that we will walk in the truth, and for us, our truth, the truth, is Jesus. So the first thing that it means to walk in the light of Jesus is to always seek to walk in his truth. The second is that to walk in the light of Jesus means to love others, to always love others. Look at verses 9, 10, and 11. There back in 1 John chapter 2, 9, 10, and 11 says this, anyone who claims to be in the light but hates his brother or sister is still in the darkness. Anyone who loves their brother and sister lives in the light, and there is nothing in them to make them stumble. But anyone who hates a brother or sister is in the darkness and walks around in the darkness. They do not know where they are going because the darkness has blinded them. There were those in John's day who were claiming to be Jesus' followers, but who were still acting and speaking on hatred. They were still using violent speech, angry speech, bitter speech against their perceived enemies and against sometimes even their own brothers and sisters in Christ. This is what John is addressing. He's saying there are some in the church today, obviously, because he has to address it. He's saying there are some who claim to be Jesus followers, but who are living their lives on a philosophy of of hatred, on an attitude of violence and bitterness and hatred. It's never been easy. It wasn't easy for them. In John's day, when John is writing this letter, you have to understand that there is a fairly systemic persecution that is going on in the Roman Empire at that time against Christians. By the time John is writing this letter in the later first century, there was heavy persecution in certain parts of the Roman Empire against the Christian movement, against Christians themselves. And so it was difficult because there was this systemic evil within the Roman Empire. At the same time that is happening, the Christians are also being persecuted by the Jewish community. By the time John is writing this letter, you see, the Judaism had coalesced around a single idea, and they were beginning to persecute the Christian community because they saw the Christian community as their greatest threat. The Jews who had believed in Jesus as Messiah and were now Christians were seen as the enemy of Judaism, as this Judaism was beginning to grow and build. Modern day Judaism was in its infancy during this time period. And so at some point, the Jews and the Christians began to separate, and there was this schism, and it became ugly, and the Jewish community was persecuting many of the Christians. There is a Jewish blessing that was one of the eight or so daily blessings that they were asked to repeat. It was also a part of the liturgy of the synagogue, this blessing that was known as the Birkat Hamimim. And it was basically called the blessing on heretics. But it wasn't a blessing at all. It was actually a curse. It was a prayer that the Jews were instructed to pray on a daily basis. Certainly every Sabbath in synagogue, they would pray this prayer together. And it was a prayer of a curse on the heretics. But by the late first century, early second century, it had become almost exclusively a curse on the Christians because they were seen as the most dangerous heretics against Judaism. Let me just read the prayer as it has come down to us, the curse. It went something like this: "For the apostates, let there be no hope, and uproot the kingdom of arrogance speedily and in our days. May the Nazarenes..." This was their name for the Christians. Jesus was from Nazareth. He was considered a Nazarene. It says, "May the Nazarenes and the sectarians perish as in a moment. Let them be blotted out of the book of life and not be written together with the righteous. You are praised, O Lord, who subdues the arrogant." This is what they were saying about the Christians. Let them be blotted out of the book of life. They're arrogant and bring their pride down. This is the way that the Christians were being persecuted. You understand, it was not easy for those first Christians to be kind to those who were trying to blot them out of the book of life, to those who were speaking evil against them. It was hard. It has always, always been hard. In every generation, there is this difficulty, a level of difficulty, in trying to love those who are giving you no reason at all to love them. John talks about this anger and this hatred and what it can do in his letter, chapter 3, where he talks about the tongue. And he says that even though the tongue is one of the smallest parts of the body, it can cause the most damage, more damage than any other part of the body. The tongue, he says, it's this like the great forest that's set on fire by a tiny spark. He says all the animals of the earth are currently being subdued. Wild beasts and birds of the air and reptiles and beasts of creatures of the sea. We're taming those animals, but who can tame the tongue? Right? He calls it this restless evil full of deadly poison, the tongue. And Jesus said, "You have heard it said, you shall not commit murder. But I say to you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Raca,'" which was a very bad word, "is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in the dangers of the fires of hell." Why is James and John and Jesus, why are they so hard on the tongue? Why are they so hard on hateful speech? Well, is because of what it does. Because that hateful speech kills the spirit of generosity. And that hateful speech kills the spirit of Jesus living in you. This is why they're so hard. Hatred of speech, hatred does two things. Harboring this hatred and not living for love of others, it does two things. He tells us what the two things it does. He says, first of all, it causes us to stumble. Look at verse 10. He says, anyone who loves their brother and sister lives in the light, and there's nothing in them to make them stumble. If you live in the light, there's nothing in you to make you stumble. But the opposite is obviously true, that if you don't live in the light, if you live in the darkness, then you're going to live a life of stumbling, holding on to anger and hatred and bitterness against someone who has done something against you. Is like taking poison and then waiting for that other person to die. The only one who's dying is you. That anger, that hatred, and that bitterness begins to eat you up from the inside, and it begins to destroy your life. And it will destroy you. It will cause you to stumble, and it will cause you to be destroyed, and it will destroy everyone around you. Unresolved anger is a poison that will ruin your life, and it will cause you to stumble. There's probably no clearer picture of that, no clearer illustration of that, historically speaking, than World War II and Hitler's Germany. You have to understand that Germany, before Hitler, was one of the most amazing cultures on the face of the earth. It was one of the most cultured nations on the face of the earth. Think about what pre-Hitler Germany, what it produced. It produced some of the most amazing musicians ever, Bach and Brahms. I'm not talking about the ice cream place, but the composer, right? Bach and Brahms and Beethoven and Strauss. These were all from Germany. It produced some of the greatest artists ever known, some of the greatest culture ever, some of the greatest scientists, Einstein and Max Born and Heisenberg. These were all some of the most brilliant scientists of their day. This is the culture that produced that brilliance. So the question is, how could that happen in a culture that was so intelligent and so cultured and so wonderful? How could a Hitler's Germany happen in that culture? And the answer is that Hitler did not happen in a vacuum. The answer is that Hitler happened because there had been centuries of anti-Semitism all throughout Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and even in the Americas. That when Hitler first took power, people in Eastern Europe and Western Europe and even people in America were applauding Hitler. They were resonating with his message because there was an ugly anti-Semitism that had been there for hundreds of years. The Jews had been persecuted in Russia. They had been persecuted in Eastern Europe. They had been persecuted in Europe. They had been persecuted in the United States for 100 years. There was this anger and hatred towards the Jews. Hitler was the psychotic spark, the match that lit the flame, but the hatred was already there. You see, this is what anger and hatred and violence will do to a culture, to a people, and to your life. It will cause ruination. It will cause you to stumble. That's the first thing. That's the first reason that Jesus is so hard on it. The second reason, he says, is that it destroys your vision. It will destroy vision. Look at verse 11. But anyone who hates a brother or sister is in the darkness and walks around in the darkness. They do not know where they are going because the darkness has blinded them. That's what darkness does. That's what hatred does. That's what not living for the truth does. That's what not living for other people does. It causes you to become blind and you lose your vision. You lose your focus. What is your focus? Where are you going? And why are you going there? If you don't know the answer to those things, then you become easily distracted. If you're living in the darkness, you're groping around and you're easily distracted and you're swayed by every wave that comes along. If you're not rooted in the love of Jesus, then you lose your focus and you forget what is the main thing. What is the main thing? Right now, I drive a 2016 Jeep Patriot. And the reason I drive that car, it's beat up. It's kind of bent in one side. The bumper has been hit, is messed up, the front bumper. It's a kind of a beat up car. It's only about 7 years old or so, but it's not pretty to look at. But it gets me from point A to point B. And the reason I'm riding that Jeep right now, was a car that I originally bought for my daughter Celeste and my son Michael when they were in high school. And it was the car they learned to drive in. That's why it's all beat up. They got into accidents and so forth and bashed in the sides and that kind of thing because they were learning to drive. Fortunately, no one was ever hurt. But that's what it looks like. And so the reason I'm driving it now is because every time I buy a new car, this is what happens in our family. When I buy a new car, the family all kind of fights over who's going to get the new car. And once they've decided who's going to be in all the different cars, then I get what's left over. That's what happens in my family. So I bought a brand new Toyota, very nice Toyota vehicle. It's a beautiful car. And so Celeste decided she wanted it, and she was in college at that time, so she took it. And I had a Lexus at that time. Michael got the Jeep. After Celeste graduated, moved to New York, she didn't need a car anymore. So then nice brand-new Toyota came back. Michael decided he wanted the Toyota. Priscilla wanted the Nissan, and so I get the beat-up right now, the beat-up Jeep. That's what I get, because that's the car that was left over. And am I upset about that? Can you tell that I'm not, right? No, I'm not. I don't care. I don't care what a car looks like. Some people would be embarrassed because it has bashed in one side and the bumper looks like it's kind of halfway falling off. And some people would be embarrassed about that. I don't care. It's a car. It gets me from point A to point B. It doesn't leave me stranded, you understand? It's just a car. I don't care what brand it is. I don't care what it looks like. In fact, the Jeep now is my favorite car, my favorite kind of car, paid for, right? I've paid it off. That's my favorite kind of car. I don't care because what it looks like is not the main thing. We have this way of losing focus. A car is to get you from point A to point B. And if it does that, then it's a good car. You understand? So you look at your life and you say, what is my life really about? What am I really called to do? What is Jesus asking me to do? He's asking you to walk in his light. That's the main thing. And what that looks like is that you love the truth. You are always seeking the truth. And what that looks like is you live for other people, that others are more important than you. This is what it looks like to live in the light. This is what it looks like to live with the Spirit of Jesus's generous, generous love. What I want us to do now to end is that I want you to spend a little bit of time reflecting on the message this morning, reflecting on 1 John. And what we're going to do is we're going to play some music while we do this, but we're going to have some questions that will come up on the screens. And as you reflect, I want you to reflect on those questions, just three or four questions that you can reflect on during this time. I want you to take this time seriously and ask Jesus, through reflecting on these questions, to speak straight from his heart to your heart about the message this morning. So go ahead and do that now.